You are listening to the Rule of Law Radio Network at ruleoflawradio.com. Live free speech talk radio at its best.
Listening to the second hour of Live and Let Live on the Rule of Law Radio Network. I'm Gary Johnson. You can hear this program for 2 hours every Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 8 Central, 7 Mountain, and 6 Pacific. Archives of this program are available at ruleoflawradio.com. In this hour, we're going to be talking with Alan Schaefer. He is the president of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. Their website is www.schoolandstate.org, and he's going to be talking about the case against government control of education. Alan Schaefer, welcome to Live and Let Live.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be here.
Well, Alan, the Alliance for Separation of School and State, as I understand it, you're basically saying that parents should get their children out of the public school system and put them in private schools or homeschool them, but do anything except keep them in the government school system. Is that right?
That's correct.
Why?
First, it is the original and best arrangement for education and for the formation of children. But secondly, we have a long list of various consequences, mostly unintended, that follow from government involvement in this particular activity. Now, of course, from your perspective, that follows with most government involvement in most activities. But it's particularly important for education because it undermines or supplants an area in which human beings have been responsible for their own action for centuries. And the government's involvement there has a profoundly foundational influence on the most foundational institution of society, which is the family, and the formation of young people who are not fully formed yet when their youth, when they're under the care of parents. A lot of our individualist views apply perfectly to adults, but they don't apply to children in the same way. And so there's a unique arrangement that is disturbed by the government's involvement in that. There's so many different aspects of how that occurs, but essentially we believe that government's involvement disturbs that very important institution of passing on the culture from parents to children.
So your organization is called the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. And I take it that you not only are encouraging parents to not have their children in the government-run school system, but ultimately you would like to abolish the public school system. Is that right?
Well, yes. We believe that that's the wrong way to administer this particular activity. But we also believe we don't have the political clout to actually change the government's mind. We do have the rational clout to change parents' minds. Not all of them, but certainly anyone who's questioning what they're experiencing in this system, we have answers that make a lot of sense.
All right. Now, you have talked about part of the problem here already, and that is that what the public school system may teach is acceptance of authority and the government is good for you. Do you feel that the public school system does it exist for the purpose of education, or does it have another agenda?
Well, this is in the nature of all what we call, you know, in the religious world, we call heresy. The nature of the beast is that there has to be some truth. Otherwise, you can't get away with the untruth part. So, yes, they do educate. They do certain functions that look like education. But fundamentally, it doesn't exist for that purpose. In other words, the administration by government isn't in order to achieve education. The achieving of education is controlled by the government in order for the government to have control. So the control is the larger reality of the system. Now, you know, it didn't happen because every person along the way that is involved with government school acknowledged that inversion of priority. Certainly most, the overwhelming majority of people involved were well-intentioned. We can go right back to Horace Mann, who essentially is the grandfather or the father of public school or government education, who sincerely believed he was going to improve society to such a degree that he would virtually empty the jails in a generation or two. That obviously didn't happen. In fact, quite the reverse happened. We have a significantly higher indices of social ill and social unhappiness and social problems than we had when he began the venture. So education was happening at a fabulous rate, at a tremendous level, long before he came along with the answer, which was to give everybody a public schooling. So it wasn't there in order to provide education. It was there in order to take control of the providing of education, ostensibly to give a better education. But we know that didn't happen.
Well, Alan, you have mentioned Horace Mann. Who was Horace Mann, and what did he do?
Horace Mann lived in the mid-1800s and fought vigorously with what were called at the time the Boston Masters. The Boston Masters were the heads of various schools in the Boston area, who provided, by the way, a superb education. And Horace Mann carried on a set of lectures or debates, basically, with the Boston Masters, arguing that we needed a universal public schooling. Now, let's put it in a context, too. This is something, I mean, history is just amazing on this. You have to be cautious, you know, with going too much backward in history. But it is very, very instructive to see what happened here. In Boston at that time, well over 90% of the students who were eligible to go to school were in school already. But Horace Mann, when he created the government schools, did not create government schools in order to catch the extra 6 or 8%. He created public schools in order to compel all students to have one kind of education. Now, let's look at the man a little bit. He was a Unitarian Universalist. He didn't much care for God. He had had a very, very bad experience of Christianity based on a preacher who basically said when his brother died, said, you know, your brother's going to hell. So he decided, well, I don't think much of that. So he kind of opted out of the religion thing. Well, you have to understand that all education at the time was religious. And so part of his agenda was to diminish the religious aspect and try to get an education that was based on rationalism more rigorously in the populace. At the same time, a huge influx of Irish Catholics mainly and also Italians were beginning to come in to the United States. And the founding of our country was based on puritanical sects of Christianity. And Horace Mann saw this as an opportunity, and he created a situation whereby he was getting the Protestants all riled up about the Catholics, and he was promising that his public schools would, quote, Americanize these immigrants. And that was code for the very clear agenda, which was to de-Catholicize them. He wanted to make them essentially diminish and give up their faith. So this is a little bit of an insight into the man. Now, obviously, he had a very strong ethical and moral value on people behaving well and being contributors to society, and that's why he thought he could empty the jails. I mean, he wasn't an evil man that was trying to undermine people just for the fun of it. He thought there was a better way. Here's the crux of the whole thing. Almost everybody thinks they've got a better way. The question is, do they have the power to impose it on other people en masse? And that's the thing that had been unprecedented with Horace Mann. He said, I don't want to just have the people that will pay for me because they think I'm a better teacher. I want to have all the people under my system so I can fix them. And that essentially gets you into the sort of the social engineering project that government schooling was originally designed to be.
Okay. Now, Alan, I think in addition to the point you made about how this was imposing, the government imposing itself upon people and parents and the children especially, one of the points that you made I'd like for you to elaborate on is that 90% or more of the children were already going to school. It was not, I think, an assumption people have is if the government doesn't run the school system, then there won't be any, no one will be going to school. But actually, nearly everyone was going to school that before the state stepped in.
That's correct. Statistics indicate that in the northern states, somewhere in the vicinity of 96% of the adult male population. Now, let's put it in a historical context. At the time, women weren't expected. It wasn't desired for women to take on literacy. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't read or have opinions or share the opinions with the decision makers, who typically were the male heads of household. They certainly did that. What it meant was they were less likely to write, to be people of letters, to communicate, you know, in a business transaction way in the world. So when we talk about literacy, what we're talking about is people who can read and write. And it was over 90% for adult male natural born, that is, people who have been born on our soil. In the southern states, it was around 92%, so it was slightly lower. But interestingly, in the northern states, the requirement to educate children was a law. They just didn't have schools provided by the government. So at any rate, that percentage is just a staggering number looked at on the world stage at the time. Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America, was an amazing observer of our early start of the country. And he was totally bowled over by the literacy rate that was universal in this country. You know, we're talking the westward expansion even. The number of books, the level at which people were reading, the level of discourse, the letters that they shared with one another, the numbers of people that were literate, the publishing business. You know, these were indicators of the way that the American people embraced their education. Now, you have to put this in another context. These are people who had fled an authority structure, a hierarchy, the benefit of institutions that had been around for a long time, institutions of learning. They no longer were near Oxford and Cambridge and London. They were on their own, out in nowhere, and they were superseding the rest of the world in pursuit of an education. And they were passing it on to their children at unprecedented rates. Indications are that people who had learned to read and write increased from something around the 60% range to something around the 90% range over a period of about 120 years, I think it was. This is just staggering growth.
All of this, Alan, is before the government takeover of education. We are talking with Alan Schaefer. He's president of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. Their website is www.schoolandstate.org.
It is so enlightening to listen to 90.1 FM, but finding things on the internet isn't so easy, and neither is finding like-minded people to share it with.
Oh, well, I guess you haven't heard of Brave New Books then.
Brave New Books?
Yes, Brave New Books has all the books and DVDs you're looking for by authors like Alex Jones, Ron Paul, and G. Edward Griffin. They even stock Interfood, Berkey products, and Calvin soaps.
There's no way a place like that exists.
Go check it out for yourself. It's downtown at 1904 Guadalupe Street, just south of UT.
Aw, by UT? There's never anywhere to park down there.
Actually, they now offer a free hour of parking for paying customers at the 500 MLK parking facility, just behind the bookstore.
It does exist. But when are they open?
Monday through Saturday, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and 1 to 6 p.m. on Sundays. So give them a call at 512-480-2503 or check out their events page at bravenewbookstore.com.
Listening to Live and Let Live on the Rule of Law Radio Network. I'm Gary Johnson. We're talking with Alan Schaefer. He is the president of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State, and he was telling us about the history of really Horace Mann and how Mann convinced Boston officials to compel children to go to government-run schools. Before Mann came along in Boston, Massachusetts in particular, Alan, the children were going to, I take it, private schools, and how were they getting their education?
Many of them were getting it at home. They were around the family Bible, volumes of Shakespeare, you know, various popular books at the time. Many people had copies of, like, you know, Thomas Paine's Common Sense was one of the most amazingly widely published books in the history at the time. And there were many, many very fine and difficult works by great authors at the time. So home was one way. Another way was what they called dame schools. A learned woman might open her house to a few students. Tutoring. Most didn't have a lot of schooling. What we call schooling today, 180 days and 6 hours a day, that was unheard of at the time. Children were very valuable in the home, and they didn't spend that kind of time acquiring an education. But if you compare letters written at the time, for instance, Civil War correspondence letters and whatnot, what you discover is they had a much better education with their few years of exposure to it than most of us have now.
Now, Horace Mann, he's this lawyer. He comes along, and he has this influence in Boston. How long did it take him to do whatever he did, and what did he accomplish?
Well, he was at it for a long time, and let's be clear about this. He wasn't alone. We mm-hmm. tend to put him up as the icon. He certainly was prolifically written and very, very vocal and all that stuff, but he was on the heels of a movement that had gotten very strong and had been sweeping the country. It was almost an evangelistic movement, and it was called the Common School Movement. So the Common School Movement is a little bit different. Their basic idea was, let's just get the merest facts in front of the bodies of the kids. You know, let's rise above our sectarian differences and provide for the kids something that we think they're not always getting. In terms of the reading, writing, arithmetic, the basic educational values. So the Common School was an attempt to provide that everywhere in the country. And the Common School Movement and Horace Mann's insistence that this ought to be the way we do it, and we should do it through the government. They came together. So there was a lot more.
Well, let me ask you a question here, Alan. Alan, was that necessary? You just told us that 90-something percent of the people were literate. So weren't they already getting the common stuff anyway?
Well, yes, many were. But there was always this sense that there were certain people that needed a leg up. There was at the time of Lincoln, I believe it was, and I'm a little fuzzy on this history. I've wanted to chase it down, but I'm aware of a great speech by John Taylor Gatto, talked about mud sill theory. Mud sill theory essentially was this a condescending, disparaging view of people that didn't have material wealth at all, that may live in a house that had dirt floor. Okay, and the object of this was to that many people believed that those people must be ignorant and be in need of something that sort of pulled them up. That wasn't actually the case. And to the extent that it was, we don't see any social index that indicates that their lack of education was a problem for them or the surrounding society either. But that was the common understanding under mudsill theory, that these people needed help. There were other forces at work as well. For instance, Lawrence, Kansas, was the staging of an unprecedented, sort of a bizarre occurrence. And again, I'm not really brushed up on the history on this, but Lawrence, Kansas, was a town that was basically fabricated from scratch. And it was the first town, as far as I know, in America that had been established based around the schoolhouse, not around the church. And that was a deliberate effort. It coincided with some other things that were going on around the same time to try to take the rebelliousness and the sort of backwardness, if you will, of the South out of them. Lawrence, Kansas was funded by a northern industrialist and came to being as a way to try to have an influence on the culture at the time and better it by education. That was what was going on at that time. So that's just one, you know, sort of microcosm of the larger idea of social change and change agency, which those sound very modern or almost, you know, sort of communist, but it was behind the common school movement.
All right, so you have these people, they want to mold society. They're master planners, I guess. And Horace Mann and others in Boston, they get, what do they get? Do they get a compulsory attendance law, or what do they
that's
end
correct.
Up getting?
Yeah, that's correct. And when it was instituted, I believe it was 1852, the parents of Barnstable, Mass., had to be convinced to relinquish their children at the force of militia gunpoint. So it was not a well-liked law at first. But people came to accept it, and it became popular and common in state after state until around the turn of the century. It was pretty much universal. Compulsory attendance, compulsory government-funded schooling was pretty much universal. There were some holdouts. The compulsory laws did not take full effect in Arizona until around, 1920. So there was a span there of, you know, 50 years or more that saw the growth of and the formation of what we would now think of as public schooling.
Now, I want to make sure I understand this. Today, we have compulsory attendance laws, but children can be homeschooled. They can go to private school. So I'm trying to understand what the Boston law, which was adopted in other states, said. You said that there were private schools and these dame schools. So, you know, a lot of kids were going to some kind of school.
Yeah.
Did they have to go to a government school? What did the compulsory attendance law or compulsory whatever it was law mean?
Sure. At first, many of the schools that had existed were sort of taken over. You would think that your schools in, you know, Massachusetts and whatnot were community schools. But actually, there was a law in Massachusetts for quite, you know, since the 1600s, the old Deluder Satan Act, where essentially it required every community that got over 50 households to pay for, build and pay for a school to which any of their children could attend. And actually, at the time, many communities chose to pay the fine to the state rather than do that because they valued their separateness or they valued their old ways of doing things or they didn't want to come up with the cost or what have you. However, you have to understand, there was a large network of existing community schools, and it just meant that the government was now going to pay for the teacher. It was going to be easier in a sense. So a lot of them just kind of tumbled along with this big idea. It wasn't that difficult to get it going. You also have to understand that not everybody did go along with this. The Catholics, for one, they rebelled. They said, you can't do that to our children. And they were quite right to say that under their religious conviction. The difficulty was they did accept one fundamental aspect of the school model that they didn't even see. And that was that in order to comply with the attendance laws, they had to not just have a separate school, they also were still forced to take the child out of the home. So at the time, it was assumed you take the child out of the home and you put them into a school, and the Catholics just said, well, we're not putting them in your school, put them in our own school. The whole thing came to a head in Oregon, I think it was, in about 1925, when Pierce versus Society of Sisters brought the whole thing to a head. In Oregon, the private schools were illegal. Catholic schools, parochial schools, private schools were illegal. You had to go to public school. And the Society of Sisters was the Catholics' attempt to roll that back and get the ability for the Catholics' kids to go to a Catholic school. And they won that case. A lot of people think that was a big victory. Actually, the case, if you read it, has a lot of bad stuff in it. But that's when we got essentially the freedoms that you see now that the private schoolers and homeschoolers enjoy. So we don't actually have a complete gunpoint to the head compulsory attendance environment right now. But we have a de facto monopoly by virtue of the schools compelling tax funding and providing the system through government.
All right, we are talking with Alan Schaefer. He's president of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. Their website is schoolandstate.org.
My name is Randall Kelton, and I co-host on Rule of Law Radio. We specialize in showing people how to strike back against corrupt public officials. With the mortgage crisis worsening, we set our sights on finding a remedy for people who have been cheated by their lenders. If you have a mortgage or have paid yours off, you have probably been cheated out of thousands. But there is a remedy. Go to remediesinrealestate.com or call me at 512-430-4140. And find out how to use the consumer protection laws to recover what the lenders have stolen through fraud and deception. We will prepare for you a qualified written request that will expose the fraud and put the lenders on the dime. Lender fraud is bankrupting this country, and it's time to fight back. Go to remediesinrealestate.com or call 512-430-4140 and get the information you need to stop the money changers in their tracks.
Listening to Live and Let Live on the Rule of Law Radio Network, I'm Gary Johnson. We are talking with Alan Schaefer. He is president of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. The website is schoolandstate.org, and he is telling us about the case against government control of education. His organization urges parents to send their children to private school or home school and to get their children out of the public school system. He's giving us a history lesson here. And Alan, you were talking about how at one point in this process that in Oregon it was illegal to have any private schools, that not only were children required to go to government-approved schools, they were required to go to government schools. And there was a case where parents went to court and won the right to actually send their children to private schools and have that count. How did they win that case? What was the basis of their victory?
It was Pierce versus Society of Sisters, and it was actually the Catholic school provider was the one who was actually making the case.
Okay.
The fundamental case relies on the parents' right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best part of the case. It does acknowledge the parents' right to choose to provide education according to their values for their children. So that's the kernel of it.
Okay. Now, actually, let's kind of segue into something here, because you have reminded me of something. On your website, schoolandstate.org, you talk about what powers and what rights parents have if they send their children to public schools. And there is a case, speaking of court cases, there's a case from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which said, and you can explain this, that parents really don't have control of their children and what their children learn in school once they send their children to the schoolhouse.
That's correct. Yep. Here's the basic quote. Once parents make the choice, this is from the Ninth Circuit Court decision, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2005. Once parents make the choice as to which public school their children will attend, their fundamental right to control the education of their children is, at the least, substantially diminished. The Constitution does not vest parents with the authority to interfere with the public school's decision as to how it will provide information to its students and what information it will provide in its classroom or otherwise. That's a pretty truncated authority. Once you put your children in there, you don't have control any longer.
Because the parents would be interfering with their children's education. This is a decision in 2005 by a federal court. What was the case about? How did that even get into court to begin with?
There was an issue of sex ed and content that parents found objectionable, and the parents wanted to have some control or say over what was being taught. As it turns out, of course, I mean, the judge isn't wrong from the standpoint that you can't have every parent tell every school what they want taught, because then you'd have chaos. You wouldn't be able to do that. You have to choose something, and this gets back to the common school. The common school is founded on a very simple idea. We will teach in common what we believe in common. And the problem with that is that we therefore necessarily have to exclude those things about which we disagree, which are always the things we hold most dear, our political opinions, our religious opinions, etc. Those things cannot be part of the formulation. So as a result, whenever those things conflict from one parent to another, from one community to another, the school must not engage in the conflict. And if a parent is trying to change what the school is teaching, they're trying to influence what is taught to all the other students. And the school simply isn't that flexible that they can change the whole curriculum for all those students just for your child. So there's a practical matter here. But the fact is that in a common school, in a public school, you can't have what you want for your children. You have to take what they give you.
Now, reading from your website, as I understand it, it wasn't just the content of the sex education that was being taught, that actually, this is Palmdale, California,
yes.
The researchers were being allowed to interview first, third, and fifth grade students about sexual urges and fantasies,
yep.
And it was these researchers asking children these very personal questions that really set the parents off. It wasn't just the teachers teaching; it was also this kind of invasion of privacy, and the parents found out about it, and they were all agitated.
That's correct.
And as you say, the problem is that you can't please everybody. Maybe some parents have no problem with that. I don't know, but. As long as the parents have no control over what's going on with their children in the schools, that's really the issue.
That's right. The bottom line issue is you don't have control when you leave your child on that off of that door. When you are a customer and you select an item, you have control over that. You can decide if you want onions and peppers on your pizza or if you want pepperoni. You don't have that choice in a government school. It's not offered to you. One pizza fits all.
All right, and this, I think, Alan, is the heart of the argument of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State, that parents should have control. They should decide what their children do, what their children learn, and it's sort of a market-based concept in that because parents are involved with a private school or certainly with homeschool, if they don't like what's being taught, you know, they can change it. They can take their children out of the school. Or actually, a private school is probably going to be a lot more responsive than a public school. In fact, a public school may not be responsive at all.
That's right. The private school is more responsive to the degree they don't mimic or copy public schools, although some certainly do. But let me just go one step further, deeper toward the principles, libertarian principles, really, that are underneath this.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, putting children into schools teaches them to live under the authority of government officials, but it doesn't teach it by the content of the curriculum. It teaches it by the very act of accepting the government's version as a handout rather than providing your own. It means you're thereby saying, I'm no expert here. I have to defer to my betters in the providing of an education for my children. It means that I accept the government's terms for my life. It means that I accept the authority that will be wielded on my child, essentially without my ability to influence it, as the Ninth Circuit Court said. And when you break that cycle of submission to that system, and you become a consumer, and you become someone who has some stake, some monetary cost involved in providing for your children, they learn an entirely different lesson, one where you're responsible, not somebody else, for your life and for your decisions and for your actions and for what you achieve. You're responsible, not the government, for providing for your life. That's the message that children hear when parents have stake in the process of providing for their education. And when they don't, it's subtle, it takes a dozen years, but it's loud and clear. The government is your master. Do you understand that distinction?
Absolutely.
The trouble is it is so subtle because it's not something where you can go into the classroom, you can sit there in front of Mrs. Smith and hear her say, you know, be submissive to authority, I'm your better because I'm paid by the government. That's not what happens. It's not in the curriculum. It's in the whole process of abdicating this process of giving our children education from the place where it was always the best and where it has always in society been vested, and that's the family. And then when we transfer that out, it sends a loud and clear message about responsibility and about participation and about independence and about stake and about doing things for yourself. Loud and clear message.
Does the government even ask? I mean, in a private school, you are, the parent is, say, the consumer and can complain and can get changes or can move the child to another school. The government, it doesn't really ask for anything. It's all dictated from the top, right? The parents.
It's worse, Gary. Here's the sad truth of it. It's a perverse incentive. Here's what happens. If your school's failing, what is the cry? Universally, in every municipality, in every
more
state.
More money.
More money. Yeah. And they get it. They get it. What happens when the money diminishes? They cry and whine as if the results are going to diminish. If you look at the actual studies of correlating results to money, some of them are flat. Many of them show an inverse relationship. Less money, better results. So why this constant cry? Failure gets them more money. It's a perverse incentive. It's the opposite of what happens in any good business, and certainly in any good school business.
All right, we are talking with Alan Schaefer. He is the president of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. We're taking a look at the track record of public education in America today and how parents have lost control of their children's education in public schools. Their website is www.schoolandstate.org. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about parent control and about the organization that Alan is heading.
Attention, an important product from hempusa.org, microplant powder, will change your life by removing all types of positive toxins, such as heavy metals, parasites, bacteria, viruses, and fungus from the digestive tract and stomach wall so you can absorb nutrients. Microplant powder is 89% silica and packed with a negative charge that attracts positive toxins from the blood, organs, spine, and brain. This product has the ability to rebuild cartilage and bone, which allows synovial fluid to return to the joints. Silica is a precursor to calcium, meaning the body turns silica into calcium and is great for the heart. There is no better time than now to have microplant powder on your shelf or in your storage shelter. And with an unlimited shelf life, you can store it anywhere. Call 908-691-2608 or visit hempusa.org. It's a great way to change your life. So call 908-691-2608 or visit us at hempusa.org today.
Schaefer of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. We're taking a look at the track record of public schools. So what is the track record of public schools? How well are they teaching?
You can just look at things like Time Magazine that did an expose on the process by which graduation rates are figured. Never mind the rates themselves. I have a chart on my wall that shows that, you know, nationwide, most municipalities are very lucky to graduate 70%, 65-70% of their kids, and some are having a hard time graduating 50-40% of their kids. So that's a kind of a track record. But what's more startling is that those numbers don't actually tell you what's going on. Another aspect of the track record, the cost. You know, we think of the cost as high. Even in D.C., they'll tell you the cost is about $16,000 a student. But they're wrong. If you actually take every line item that relates to the provision of public schooling and you add it up and divide it by the number of students that they report, you get $28,000. So that the numbers don't even really tell you what's going on. So let's just suffice to say it's a disaster. It's not good. Everyone knows it's not good. But I want to point to a very, very important point. Everyone knows it's not good, except almost everyone thinks that it's different in their town. Their town's okay. They know their teachers. They're pretty sure their kid's getting an education. And that's one of the difficult things to break through. Probably the most difficult.
All right. So that, what is the alternative? How many students are not in the public school system today?
It's hovering around 12 to 13%. And homeschoolers are advancing that number. Private schools had been growing, but since the crash, private schools have taken the bit on the chin. I don't think we have any accurate recent numbers to juxtapose the peak to what they're experiencing now. And of course, you know, this happens because the public schools appear to be free. So at any rate, but it hovers around that in the low teens.
And of course, to send your children to private school, you're paying twice because you paid for it with your public schools with your taxes, and then you pay again for the private school.
That's correct.
But that is the alternative the Alliance for the Separation of School and State is advocating. At the beginning of the program, we talked about you really want to get the government out of education. You want to end the government takeover of education, but that is a long-term goal.
That's right. You know, let's put this in perspective. If you have children, then you've got a window of about a decade for their lives. And if you're waiting for a reform, if you're trusting a reform, if you're in there battling and trying to make good on a bad job, if you are hoping against hope, if you're moving from one municipality to another to get a better school, then your children are slipping away from you. And that decade's going to go way too fast. But now I'm a homeschooling father, so I'm fond of homeschooling, and I'm not disparaging private schools at all, but I just want to leapfrog the private school for just a moment to show you what's possible. What's possible is that the trend that we can see in the schools, lower test scores, lower readiness for college, lower readiness for job skills, lower graduation rates, lower social indices, higher social pathologies, whether it's drug use, teen pregnancy, whatever your index is that you want to look at, it's worse. Okay, but in the homeschooling community, you can look at all of those indices, and all of them are reversed across the whole community. We're talking 2 million kids. So this isn't just a small sampling here. All of those indices are reversed almost overnight. You can have what we've lost for your children overnight. Now, it takes a sacrifice. But what we're advocating is make the sacrifice, because not only are you giving to your children what they need for their lives, you're giving to this society a foundation that is much stronger than the one that we're getting from the government schools. So much so is this true that I will guarantee that all the other topics that you entertain, Gary, on your show, I'm going to go away and people are going to forget about schools. They're going to think about guns. They're going to think about drugs. They're going to think about roads. They're going to think about, reducing the taxes. They're going to think about resisting, Tea Party, whatever it is they're going to think about. Let me just say this right here now, because this is the most important thing I think you're going to hear from me on this show. If you get all of your vote wishes, if you get all of your agenda wishes, if you get all of your adult people lined up to make those changes today, they will reliably be unraveled in a generation, in a decade or two, by the children who are coming through that system. They're not thinking like you, and they're not going to. They're lost. We need to regain those children, and I can guarantee you can do that. Guarantee, that's a big word. I can show you overwhelming statistics that if you take control of your children's education, particularly through homeschooling, but also it can be done through private schooling as well, a little more money, but it's still worth it. If you can take control of your children's education, you can reverse all those likelihoods that I just listed from the government school, and you don't have to wait for a reform. It's too valuable not to do it.
When Alan, right now, 2 million students are being homeschooled. Millions more are going to private schools. I want to make sure I want to understand something, because we talk about this history of the legality. Is it legal to homeschool in all 50 states?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right. And the Alliance for the Separation of School and State, this was founded by Marshall Fritz, and he passed away a couple of years ago, right?
Yes, he passed away actually on Election Day when Obama was elected.
And so you are running the show now, and I understand that you are planning some changes and, getting things going again. So what's going on with the Alliance for the Separation of School and State?
We're headed into a new phase where instead of making a big point about what's wrong with the government's involvement, we want to make our big point about how superior an independent product is. We want to provide the best platform for the best independent alternatives to be ready-to-hand resources for parents to make a better decision. We want to give them a thought framework that helps them evaluate their own choices for their own children right now without having to go over Horace Mann and all the rest of the past, without having to talk about how bad the government is from a libertarian perspective. We simply want to demonstrate to them that this is better for their children. We also want to try to find a way, as many ways as possible, to create a synchronous involvement of a whole bunch of independent school providers, homeschool curriculum providers, etc., people who are very serious about this work, to try to create a greater competitive advantage against the government school. Right now, the government school, of course, is free, and private schools are expensive. You know, a minimum of $2,000-$3,000 at the very cheapest for the very luckiest, and up to $6,000. The averages are over $5,000. Yes, it's expensive. What if we could create a situation where we made it so advantageous for people to choose the independent choice that they began to compare the two on the merits of their product, not on which one was free and which one cost them their vacation? Do you see where I'm going? We're trying to find a way to make it so that these people will choose based on the results, not based on the money and the convenience. Now, that's a very tall order. We have to start someplace, so we're going to start in one location to try to help parents to look at this a different way and see if they can change their habit from dependency on government school to an independently provided model. We happen to be in a situation where there are places that desperately need our help along these lines. There are already municipalities, typically inner-city municipalities, that are privatizing the providing of their product. What if we could not only privatize, but run essentially the same schools in the same buildings? What if we could instead bring in a mix of providers who offer different things, and the parents would have choices that they could choose from? Specialties of various kinds. They wouldn't be stuck in a one-size-fits-all system. We'd like to create that environment, and that's essentially where we're heading. It's very exciting.
All right, and I understand you're in a transition here. The people can still go to www.schoolandstate.org, and for one thing, I understand that they can read about a six-part series called The Road to Freedom. What is that all about?
Essentially, it is our short course on essentially what the problem is. And we encourage that for anyone for whom this is new territory, new information. It helps establish the fact that there is a problem, the fact that the problem is the nature of the problem, and the fact that they can be hopeful and that there are solutions. It's essentially an introduction. And I would strongly suggest that anybody that reads that also follow through, correspond with me. My contact information is on the site so that we could begin to address specifically what you're concerned about and help you find the solutions that best fit your situation.
And I know that on the schoolandstate.org, You have a lot of information that I guess is answering the kinds of objections that people have, the concerns people have. You have like a knowledge base and that sort of thing.
There are quite a few articles on that. It's a very deep and rich site. If you get into it a little bit, you will discover this is not a surfacey kind of a trendy view of things. This is somewhat heavy sledding, but it's absolutely worth taking the ride through, because by the time you look through this information, particularly the knowledge base, your understanding of what you see on the news, what you read in the paper, how you interact with other people, I guarantee will be elevated. You will understand things you never could put together before, because you can't truly understand what's going on in our current situation unless you understand how we got here. Why is it the way it is? Well, we have an insight into why that is. We've been robbed. Parents have been robbed of their confidence to do this job themselves. And our organization exists to restore to parents the confidence and sovereignty to do this work that is such an essential chore, essential tool for the shaping of the society.
We want to give that back to them. Alan Schaefer, president of the Alliance for the Separation of School and State. Again, your main point is that parents should get their children out of the public school system, and eventually the government should not be running a public school system. Thank you, Alan Schaefer, for being with us here on Live and Let Live.
Thank you very much, Gary. Appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
This program was directed by Matt Finkel. Executive in charge of production was Deborah Stevens. This is Live and Let Live on the Rule of Law Radio Network. You can hear this program every Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Gary Johnson. Good night.
My name is Randall Kelton, and I co-host on Rule of Law Radio. We specialize in showing people how to strike back against corrupt public officials. With the mortgage crisis worsening, we set our sights on finding a remedy for people who have been cheated by their lenders. If you have a mortgage or have paid yours off, you have probably been cheated out of thousands. But there is a remedy. Go to remediesinrealestate.com or call me at 512-430-4140. And find out how to use the consumer protection laws to recover what the lenders have stolen through fraud and deception. We will prepare for you a qualified written request that will expose the fraud and put the lenders on the dime. Lender fraud is bankrupting this country, and it's time to fight back. Go to remediesinrealestate.com or call 512-430-4140 and get the information you need to stop the money changers in their...